Session number 12586, Reel 2.
Ted Leather, Reel 2.
The commander of the ship, Commander Lawson, came down and he spoke to me personally and asked me if I'd go up on the bridge to help to clear the bridge. Now, he said that you'll get quite a shock when you go up there, so be prepared for the worst. Now, I went up, and I remember with me was a Petty Officer Davis and about three or four other ratings. We arrived on the bridge to see such a state as to be unbelievable to me. The captain, Captain Leach, in his greatcoat, was standing in the centre at the Pylorus, the compass, and this bridge was an absolute shambles behind him. There was a hole on the starboard side forward of the bridge. It was an enclosed bridge. The shell had came across, killing those in its path, and as it went out the other side of the bridge at the after end, coming across, it exploded. On the outside of the bridge, as we arrived up, there was people of the sick berth party giving assistance to the young Marine bugler, who was extremely badly wounded. Now, on the bridge itself, as I arrived on with these others, it was quite sickening to see. The shell had came across, it had hit the chart table. To describe it was something of this nature: there was two half midshipmen, and then there was another couple of bodies, and then over on the port side where it had exploded, there was another body.
Two half midshipmen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The shell had killed them all on its path across.
Just torn them in half.
Yes. Yes, yes. And over on the port side as it went, I do believe, thinking back, that it was the captain's messenger, an able seaman, but the skin was burnt off his body at the top part until he was practically, you were looking at the skull of a skeleton, practically. We started, they brought hammocks up and we lifted these parts of bodies and bodies into the hammocks to be carried off the deck.
Were they all screaming with pain?
No, they were dead. They were dead. There was only two alive on the bridge when I got up there. That was the captain, Captain Leach, and to his left there was a chappie in a brown duffel coat, holding a telephone. But he was looking ahead. Probably the captain had said to him, keep looking ahead. But the captain was giving his orders quite normally down. Proud moment to see your captain so cool and calm with all this behind him on the bridge. Anyway, we lifted these parts of bodies into hammocks, lifted them to the outside of the bridge, and by this time, by some arrangement, a lot of water had been brought up to the bridge in buckets and scrubbers with isol in them, and we began washing down the bridge. The only recollection I can have of this, something that happened on the bridge, was that the captain suddenly remarked, see to him, and he was pointing to this able seaman who had the form in his hand. But when we went to see to him, I don't know exactly what had happened to him, whether he was fainting through what he'd gone through and saw, But in his duffel coat there was a big jagged cut as if something had torn. So whether he had a wound underneath that, I will never know. But that's what it was like. So we started to scrub the bridge around. Now, can I say that here was a scene whereby the back of the captain's big black greatcoat was also covered in human hairs and body, bits of blood and everything. We finally got it all cleared up to the satisfaction of the commander. Then we returned down below. You know, I went back to my duties. This took quite some time, obviously. Now, this would be while we were joining up probably with the Suffolk and Norfolk to continue the search, like, you know, for the ships. So that was the part I played in that particular action. Now, after that, we just remained closed up. And then I just cannot recollect whether it was the following day or not, when we had to leave the scene to go to Iceland. Is it Reykjavik?
Reykjavik.
Yeah. Reykjavik in Iceland.
Before you go there, during the action, was the worst part of it clearing up the bridge or receiving the news of the loss of the hood or what?
To me, the worst part of the action was going on that bridge and seeing the state of the bridge. I think I'd been so preoccupied in my duties within the turret that wasn't time to think of what's other things. You're just dealing with what goes on at the moment. Although I was very surprised when I came out and saw the state of my own ship. You know, with the boats on fire on the deck, one could see we'd been hit and such as that. But when I went on the bridge to clear it and saw the state of that bridge, I'm still puzzled to this day how Captain Leach himself wasn't killed with the others, you know. Except, as I say, it was the way the shell had came in from to his right at the forward end of the bridge, passed behind him, killing them all. The yeomen, the signals, all them were killed, had gone out the other side. I believe that the navigator had been on the bridge, but he'd been carried off the bridge before we'd got up there, because the shell had hit his navigating table and splintered it and such as that, and he'd been badly hurt by that. But so that's what went on as far as I was concerned. Now then, to go back to the story, we left and continued to Reykjavik in Iceland, and on the way we buried our dead. However, to go back just a little, I have to say that we did open fire again on the Bismarck the latter part of the evening. Also at the end of that evening, we saw the aircraft flying over us looking for the Bismarck. Now, I think the ship that left was the Victorious. I think the Victorious was there. It came, you know, from the Mediterranean. So their torpedo bombers had flown over us. And then, as I say, we left to go to Iceland. And when we got to Iceland, the ship was tilted to port, because we developed a list to starboard, but that was because a couple of shells had hit us below the waterline and gone in, and of course we'd gone to starboard, listed to starboard a little. The ship was listed to port while damage control went on, and then of course we came down to Rosyth for docking. So during the docking, of course, we were all given a spot of leave, obviously, during that docking period. But when I returned, there was a situation arose whereby the ship was suddenly cleared of everybody, The orders was piped like, leave the ship and get onto the jetty ashore. So we all got ashore, and then it was explained to us that a shell had been found in an oil tank down below in the ship. A crane came along, this shell was gingerly hoisted out of the ship and placed on a wagon alongside. I have no idea what happened to it, but although we were told to clear the ship in case it exploded, or something of that nature might have happened, it was surprising to see the number of people that the photographs taken with this shell, you know, on the on this wagon later. Now the ship was then repaired, and would it be in the August, I think it would be, when we were told to prepare. Well, we knew something was happening. We were getting lots of stores and everything aboard when suddenly Sir Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister, with all his staff, joined the ship, and we sailed out to Scapa Flow to, I forget the name of the bay, doesn't come to mind at the moment, it's all in my book there, Placentia Bay, for the signing of the Atlantic Charter. Now, while going across there, the Churchill had brought films with him, like, you know, and we saw some of the films while going across, went into Placentia Bay, and I remember very well that I was like a second quartermaster, having been detailed for that duty, when Roosevelt himself came aboard from a destroyer alongside on the arm of his son, who I believe was a major in their American forces. And he came across the gangway, was met by Churchill and such as that. He's as close to me as I am to you at the moment. Supported, and I believe we had a wheelchair ready for him, which he ignored, because he did suffer with polio, you know. Well, then he inspected a guard of Marines on the quarterdeck. In the meantime, there was a lot of friendship between the American ships and ours. We were visiting them, they were visiting us. We were keeping a totter run for them, like, you know. I went over to an American cruiser, battleship, which I think was the Arkansas at the time, to see a film and sit with the American sailors. Then on the Sunday morning, whilst we were there, there was a big church service attended by Roosevelt himself and all his staff, Churchill and the staff, on the quarterdeck of the Prince of Wales. It was quite moving, actually, because under the four guns of the after turret, we were all just standing there, mixed with the American sailors, you know, singing the hymns, and for those in peril on the sea, like, you know, O Trinity of Love and Power and all that kind of thing. And it was quite moving, because after the service, we were moving away to allow them to pass. And as much as the officers were trying to move us one side, most of the ship's company hadn't seen them both, you understand, so they were trying to get near, and in the end Churchill more or less waved and said, look, let them come near us if they wish to. And so they were quite surrounded on the upper deck of the ship. Well, then we sailed away from there after this. All the business had gone on between the Prime Minister and President. And on the way home, we run into a very large convoy, and a signal was hoisted that Churchill was on board, and we run up and down through the convoy at full speed, and he was on the quarterdeck. looking out at the convoy of ships. We arrived back in Scapa, but just before, I think we gave a gunnery exhibition for him.
Did you come close to Churchill during the voyages?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes.
Or speak to him?
No, I never spoke to him. No. But quite close to him, very often, like, you know, one would pass him, just going through the mess decks and such as that. And, of course, the day he came aboard with the President, I was right close to him, so very close, like, you know, I could have touched them both. So, anyway, then we returned, and that would be in August. September went by, back at Scapa Flow. And then, towards the end of October, we were ordered down to Greenock, where we were a hive of activity, so we knew something was coming off, but what, we didn't know. Not on the lower deck, probably the officers didn't know, maybe only the captain knew what was going to happen. But we were storing ship and everything, and then the Admiral joined us, and off we went to Singapore. We sailed away with some destroyers. Oh, Electra and Express was with us all the way. They went all the way with us. Down to South Africa. We had some guns brought aboard, Bofa guns, which were going to be fitted while we were in Cape Town. We didn't stay in Cape Town as long as we would have liked to, or what was originally planned. We only stayed a few days, and then we were on our way to Ceylon. Now, it was there that we picked up the Repulse, and we sailed together to arrive in Singapore early December. I think it was about December the 2nd we arrived in Singapore.
Was there any rivalry between the two ships?
Well, if there was, I didn't notice any. I didn't notice. There was a lot said afterwards, but that, you know, one, what I've read in books and such as that. But on a personal basis, I never saw any. You know what I mean? We just met up with the ship and that. And when we left there, I think it was Trincomalee, the Repulse led us out because he was a senior officer to Captain Leach.
How did you feel about going out to the Far East?
Well, I'm sorry, it's difficult to give a personal feelings. I mean, as far as I was concerned, we were just out doing the job. But I was rather saying to myself, oh, it'll be all right when we get to Singapore, like, you know, having been out there in the pre-war years. No war on out there, as far as we were concerned. We were going out for a little rest period because, oh, I'm sorry, I've got to go back a moment. We'd done a convoy to Malta. Went on a convoy to Malta after we'd been to Placentia, that's right. Operation Halberg, I remember, Halbard or something like that. And we'd done a convoy to Malta.
What happened on that?
Well, I just found that it was an extremely busy time. We'd gone on to, I think we took 14 ships through and lost one, but we lost some of our own ships. We lost one of the convoy. During that, it was a very tiring experience, the Malta convoy. It was simply because you were closed up practically the whole of the time to Malta and back again to Gibraltar. We had a call. I know we were expecting to meet the Italian fleet. There was a call that, you know, we deviated from the convoy to go and meet up with a supposed Italian fleet, but it all that fell apart. We didn't actually meet up with them. We came and rejoined the convoy. On the way back to Gibraltar, I think it was HMS Rodney or Nelson, I'm not quite sure, she got a torpedo into her bows from one of the Italian aircraft, and this slowed the speed, so we had to escort her back to Gibraltar. Then of course, you know, we came back to UK, and then I'm continue my story. We went to Greenock to go out to the Far East. Now, the last, I think I was going out to the Far East, wasn't
yes,
I?
You were
I was
talking
on the way
about
to Singapore.
We're looking forward
That's
to
right.
going to Singapore.
That's right. Now, of course, the ships were lit up and everything. The Admiral was visiting here and there and everywhere. But I think it was about the 7th of December when very early one morning, action station sounded off. And I closed up at the 525 gun, which was my duty, second captain of turret. And we were suddenly firing, and it was simply because the Japanese were now bombing Singapore early in the morning. Then we actually fired the 525 guns. Then after that,
how much damage was done in that raid?
Not a lot. Not a lot to Singapore at the time. It was not a great deal.
How surprised were you that the Japanese had attacked?
Well, very surprised. I mean, war hadn't been declared or nothing. It was just that suddenly we were firing into the air and we could only assume that it was the Japanese, that we were closed up. Then later on, of course, it was proved that it was the Japanese we were firing at. So they were actually attacking Singapore without any declaration of war.
Was there any sense of outrage?
Oh, yes, with among us all, obviously. Like, you know, we were saying, you know, they haven't declared war. He's us opening fire on them. Did we do right, you know, or all this kind of thing. Anyway, then I think it was the morning of the 8th that in the evening we set sail, and we went up looking for the enemy, I suppose, like, you know. I mean, plenty of stories have been told about it. I just carried on my main duties, and then on the day, there was little whispers went round the ship that an aircraft had sighted us the evening before. Then on that particular morning of the 10th of December, we were coming back down the coast, and one of the destroyers was sent inshore because I think it was the Express, because there was supposed to be landings ashore, that, you know, by the Japanese. It came back to report there was nothing happening. And then, I always remember, it was about 11 o'clock in the morning, because I can recollect it so easily by the sounding off the rum call for going getting the rum. And we fell in on the upper deck when suddenly action stations sounded, and I dashed off to my turret. Well, very, very shortly after that, of course, the Japanese torpedo bombers were among us. We were firing at them in the 525. In my second captain of turret, my duty was to ascertain that the gunhouse above was kept well supplied with ammunition. We were firing at them, and bang, bang, so and so and so and so. When suddenly the ship shuddered, so, you know, I thought, like, you know, we were going to blow up the way the ship shuddered, and we took a definite list to port, well over to port. Now, at that moment, as it happened, our turret trainer locked the turret on in its position where it was. Otherwise, it would have swung inboard just with its sheer weight. Can you understand what I mean? So we were locked in a position at about 45 degrees from the bow, but with the ship being tilted over, the guns up in the air, obviously. So there was nothing really we could fire at, although we still heard, like above us as we came out the turret, the pom-poms were still firing and the Bofors guns. The Japanese aircraft then high-level bombed us. And in my position by the catapult, where I came up by the catapult, a bomb entered right in the centre of that and went into what we call the cinema flat underneath and exploded, where all the working parties were, such as sick bay parties and such as that. Now, what went on down there, I cannot explain, of course, because I'm on the upper deck. The next thing that happened was that the HMS Express came alongside us on the starboard side. Now, we were well tilted to port by this time. Now, she came alongside, she was secured alongside, and lots of people started to go across to her. Now, while they were going across to her, some even going on the ropes to go across, some unfortunately were falling between the two ships, and one could hear the screams as they did it. They didn't have the strength to get across. Now, I witnessed all that, but at that moment, I can always remember Lieutenant Beckwith, who was the second gunnery officer of the ship, came to me and told me to get some ammunition from S3 turret into S2. Now, the S1 turret, S3 and S4 had swung inboard. We were the only turret locked in an outboard position. So with the aid of another couple of petty officers and some boys out of my own turret, we carried about 8 rounds of ammunition from S3 into the gunhouse of S2, my turret. I remember Lieutenant Beckwith saying, "Where's your captain of the turret?" I said, "I don't know." Now, it wasn't Petty Officer Strevens by this time. I'd had a change of captain of the turret during the cruise out there, going out there. I got into the turret with Lieutenant Beckwith. We rammed home some rounds of, some 5.25. Only him and I in the turret, and he fired them off. And that was the last turret to fire. We came out of the turret, because obviously we were firing at nothing. And by this time, the Express, we developed such a list, the Express started to cast off her ropes. Now, the screaming that went on was no odds to anybody, simply because people were falling between the two ships. Some people were actually running and trying to